Everybody who has a constitutional issue he wants to discuss is likely to go back and say, well, the founders thought this and the founders thought that. And that's fraught with peril because, of course, there were lots of founders and they thought lots of different things. But when it comes to one topic, religious freedom, there's one founder, or perhaps two, that come to mind most frequently. Thomas Jefferson is probably on the tip of your tongue. I would add James Madison, who was just as important. But Thomas Jefferson and religious freedom go together. So guess what? That's what we're talking about today. It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and it's all about T. Jeffy and religious freedom.
Your weekly constitutional is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Professor of Constitutional Law, Stuart Harris.
John Ragosta is a lawyer and a recent PhD in early American history who's now teaching at Oberlin College, a wonderful institution up there in Ohio. And he has written about a fascinating topic. He's written about Thomas Jefferson and religious freedom. Now, you might be thinking, that's the last thing the world needs, another book about Thomas Jefferson, another book about religious freedom. I mean, they're choking the bookshelves with those things, aren't they? But John did something that was somewhat unusual. He noticed some years ago, as a lawyer, that there was some pushback on the Supreme Court from some of the more socially conservative justices, notably Chief Justice Rehnquist, but also Justices Scalia and Thomas. And they were pushing back when people were citing Jefferson. They were saying, wait a second. Jefferson, you know, he's not even at the Constitutional Convention. You know, why do we care so much what Thomas Jefferson thinks about religious freedom? And they tried to cite other people from the early founding era, or maybe a little bit later, for contrary views. Because, you know, Jefferson has what's commonly called a fairly strict separationist view of the Constitution when it comes to religion. He, generally speaking, feels that the state and religion don't mix very well. And people who feel differently, well, they don't necessarily want to cite Thomas Jefferson. So John Ragosta said, that's a fair question. Why do we talk so much about Thomas Jefferson and his friend and partner, James Madison? Why do we take that perspective as our foundation? And he went back and he did some research, and he found some fascinating things. And rather than tell you myself, I'll let John do it.
My name is John Ragosta. I'm currently a visiting professor of history at Oberlin College, teaching early American history, but I have a background in law. I practiced law for almost 20 years before returning to school for my degree in history.
And you went to the University of Virginia, didn't you?
That's true, Mr. Jefferson's university, and studied topics very dear to Mr. Jefferson, in particular, the development of religious freedom in this country.
I can think of no better place to study religious freedom than the University of Virginia, and so that's just exciting as can be. But before we get into that, I must comment that you have just described the fantasy of many a practicing attorney. And that is, the fantasy is to leave the practice of law and to concentrate on some aspect of it, constitutional law, I'm supposing, in your case, in constitutional history, that is particularly intriguing. And how did that come about? How did you decide to leave, and how did that work?
Well, I encouraged them to leave, to do it. I enjoyed the practice of law. I think one of the things that people should understand, especially young lawyers, let me speak to the young lawyers who may be listening. Many people enter the law and decide they shouldn't be lawyers. After a year, 2 years, they don't like the practice. It's not what they should be doing. Dad and mom wanted them to be lawyers. That's one thing, but my situation was somewhat different. And I think a lot of people love the law, love the practice of the law, do it for many years, but it's a very difficult, very tiring practice, and there are other things in life. So after 20 years, very successful career in international trade, I decided it was time to do some other things. Went back to school. So I encourage people to do it.
Well, I'm just curious now, how long did it take you to get a PhD after having gone back to school?
Well, I was able to do my master's part-time while I was still working in Washington, D.C. at George Washington University. George Washington University is great for part-time degrees because they have so many people working in the government who do that. And so I spent 2 years part-time on my master's and then 4 years to finish my PhD. I also taught as an adjunct at the law school for a while. So I think George Washington does a fabulous job of using the resource they have there in Washington, D.C. This is another popular topic people were becoming very concerned about in academia is the overuse of adjuncts.
Yes.
And what that does to academia. GW did it right, and I have nothing but praise for them. I think many other schools are really abusing that process. And having gone back to school, I maybe have a greater appreciation for the beauty, the wonder, the success of American academia than many people. And I hate to see it assaulted.
I agree with you 100%, John, and I think that it's a crime, and I think we need more full-time faculty who can devote themselves fully both to scholarship and to teaching. But that's a whole nother subject. So let's talk about why I called you today. We're going to talk about, I guess, your dissertation, which developed into a book about religious freedom.
Well, this was actually a second book. My dissertation was a little earlier. But this is a book that I wrote mostly at Monticello, which was wonderful. After I graduated with my PhD, I received a fellowship to work at the International Center for Jefferson Studies at Monticello for a year. And no place like Jefferson's Monticello to be studying religious freedom. And wrote this book, Religious Freedom, Jefferson's Legacy, America's Creed.
John, I think you're right. I think there's no better place in the world to write about religious freedom, except perhaps Montpelier, which I have to plug since Montpelier underwrites my show. But Monticello's not bad either. So tell us about this book.
Well, that's true. Montpelier and Mr. Madison gets a lot of coverage in this book as well, although he doesn't appear in the title. The book actually got started because of our association of Jefferson with religious freedom. And in particular, in 1985, in the Moment of Silence case, Wallace versus Jaffrey, then Justice Rehnquist, he was not yet Chief Justice, in dissent, basically questioned why Jefferson? You know, why not look at other founders when we talk about religious freedom? And besides that, Jefferson's out in left field, according to Rehnquist. That yes, he drafts the Virginia Statute for Establishing Religious Freedom, but 12 of the 13 states, Virginia excepted, still have test oaths, still have established churches back when the First Amendment is adopted. So Rehnquist poses this very legitimate historic challenge. I think he's all wrong, but it's a very legitimate question. Who should really define religious freedom? And so I set off to look at that, and then having concluded it was Jefferson, and I'm sure we can talk about that, a second question, which is what did Jefferson mean by that? How did he understand the notion of religious freedom?
Yeah, it is a legitimate question. In fact, we should always question our premises. So why do you think Jefferson should be the guy? Why should we look to him as the primary informer of what we think about religious freedom?
Well, of course, I'm looking at it from a historic perspective. And so I asked this question. How would you know who, at the time the First Amendment is adopted and in the early Republic, the 1790s, the early 1800s, how would you know, question I'm often asking my students, how they define religious freedom? Who would you turn to? So I looked at a number of things. One of the things I did was look in newspapers, because we have the ability to do that now. 30, 40 years ago, you couldn't do that. But now I can go online to a historic database and do a word search, religious freedom, church state. Jefferson, Madison. And what I found was scores of newspaper articles that would talk about Jefferson, would talk about his statute for establishing religious freedom, would talk about Madison's memorial and remonstrance. And they would do this in the context of debates over religious freedom in the state of Connecticut, in the state of South Carolina. An editor would say, well, we're having this debate about church-state issues, and I just want to remind people of what that great patriot Thomas Jefferson said. And they would print the entire statute for establishing religious freedom, or they would print Madison's entire memorial and remonstrance, which, as you know, these are long documents.
So the newspaper editors themselves, and we're going back to, I'm guessing, at least the early 19th century here, are themselves identifying Jefferson and Madison as their sources.
That's right. And I cut it off in 1879, actually. And the reason I cut it off in 1879 is that's the first Supreme Court case about the meaning of the religion clauses. It was actually the Mormon polygamy case. And the Supreme Court relies on Jefferson and Madison. So I say after that time, maybe people are just repeating what the previous Supreme Court said. Well, then I wanted to look at the states. I said, well, what did the state constitutional conventions look at? because many of the states have constitutional conventions throughout the 19th and even into the 20th century. And that was one of the things that Justice Rehnquist cited. He said, look, 12 of the 13 states still have restrictions and basically have cooperation between church and state. So there's another place to look. And I spent time looking at that. And what I found was he's right. 12 of the 13 states had these restrictions. But before 1879, every one of those states changes their constitutions, and they move them in a distinctly Jeffersonian direction.
So in other words, these state establishments of religion, which incidentally Madison wanted to ban when he wrote the Federal Establishment Clause, and he didn't get that far, they can be seen as in some sense retrograde at the time that the Bill of Rights was passed in 1791. But then over the course of the next several decades, everybody moves toward the Jeffersonian, Madisonian ideal.
Exactly. And so Justice Rehnquist and now Justice Thomas, Justice Scalia, say, well, look at what these states were doing. They still had state government religion cooperation. And that's true. But then they went through and started rejecting that. And then I asked myself, well, why are they rejecting that? Is it because of a Jeffersonian ideal? And what I found is in the North Carolina state constitutional debates.
John, before we get there, and I want to hear about that because, in fact, by coincidence, I just did a whole episode on North Carolina's ratification. But you mentioned two things that some people might not be familiar with. So I want to make sure that everyone is. First of all, you mentioned the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom. And I want to talk about that. That's from Jefferson directly. And then the Memorial and Remonstrance. Could you give me a thumbnail sketch of what those two documents are and how they relate to each other?
Right, Stuart, very good question. We need to understand that in Virginia, before the American Revolution, Virginia actually has a very strict establishment. You have a state church, the Anglican Church, the Church of England. Everybody has to pay taxes to support Anglican priests. Everybody has to attend church at least once a month. Now, they could go to a Presbyterian meeting house, but there's very few of those that are licensed. The Anglican ministry has civil responsibilities. So, for example, orphans they're responsible for, poor relief they're responsible for. You had a very strong established church. Before the Revolution, they were throwing Baptist and Presbyterian ministers in jail for preaching without a license or disturbing the peace. During the Revolution, Virginia completely flips. And we can go into the details, but the end of the story is in 1786, we end up with Jefferson's Statute for Establishing Religious Freedom, which is this beautiful, very broad statement of religious freedom. It starts out, God hath created the mind free, and therefore government cannot restrict it.
I think the first line of that statute, every time I read it or hear it, just makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking about Thomas Jefferson and religious freedom with a fellow by the name of John Ragosta, who's gone back and addressed the question, why is it that whenever we talk about that subject, we always talk about T. Jeffy? After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and talk some more to John Ragosta. Stick around. He is, and once again, he is wearing his bright red Riddler cape. Is it the Riddler?
It's the Riddler.
Riddler, Doug Smith, welcome to the studio.
Thanks,
and I'm
Stuart.
So excited that you are here in costume today.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, whenever I have a riddle, I try to dress for the occasion.
And indeed you are, dressed to the nines. Do we have a riddle contestant?
We do indeed.
Well, who are you, sir?
Yes, my name's Chris. I'm calling from, appropriately enough, Madison, Wisconsin.
Matt, that is a tremendous, wonderful place, Madison. And do you listen to... I guess we're not on the radio in Madison, are we?
No, we aren't. But I've got all your podcasts downloaded after my parents took a trip out to Montpelier last year.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Have you listened to every one of them?
I heard about it from one of the souvenirs I got from them.
Well, I'm so pleased. So people, that Chris's family is presenting quite a model of behavior here. You come to Montpelier, you learn about the show, you go home, and then you listen to every single one of the podcasts.
This is a man who knows Madison.
And you do know Madison, Chris, and then you get on the phone to your local public radio station and you badger them until they put us on their station.
Ah, badger, I get it. Sure.
Okay, Doug, you got a good riddle?
I do have a riddle. So here it goes. I'm going to read the riddle, and then I'm going to give you four choices.
Okay.
A journey that started with trains in Louisiana, creating a court case that was Jim Crow's best friend. Only Brown could reverse what SCOTUS had done, because Plessy v. Ferguson made racists think they'd won. What was the Plessy v. Ferguson case about? A. Judicial review. B. Separate but equal. C. The creation of the National Transportation and Safety Administration. Or D. Integration.
Oh, that's tough. That is a tough one. So the question boils down to, what was Plessy about?
What was Plessy about?
And what were the choices again?
A. Judicial review. B. Separate but equal. C. Creation of the National Transportation and Safety Administration. D. Integration.
Do you have any idea there, Chris?
Okay. Well, I think I got a pretty good idea. I think we can, first of all, cross out the transportation one. I don't think we've got a good case for that one.
It did actually involve railroads, but okay.
It did, but yeah, I don't think it created any particular agency.
Okay.
And I think a judicial review had already been decided earlier.
I think we've got a scholar on the line here, Doug.
He knows Madison.
He knows Madison.
Yeah, I think Madison has something to do with that judicial review one as well. So I think we're down to the either integration or separate but equal. And I think...
Well, why don't you read the riddle one more time. Read the riddle one more time, if you would, Doug.
So it's a journey that started with trains in Louisiana, creating a court case that was Jim Crow's best friend. Only Brown could reverse what SCOTUS, the Supreme Court of the United States, had done, because Plessy v. Ferguson made racists think they'd won.
Oh, okay. All right. So I think we do have an integration or a separation here. I think I'm going to have to go with the answer B, the separate but equal, being a good friend of Jim Crow there.
Separate but equal, being a good friend of Jim Crow. Well, did he get it?
He did.
Hey, congratulations, Chris. Well done.
Plessy v. Ferguson.
That was tough. And in fact, you did something, Doug, that I sometimes do on my multiple choice exams, my final exams, is I will have two relatively easy choices to eliminate, and then it comes down to two that are tough. But I think that line about the racists having won or thinking that they'd won, at least that was a clue that would have clued me in. How about you, Chris?
Yeah, that was a good one. I think that was the one that helped narrow it down as far as I needed to go with it.
Well, tremendous. Well, you have now got your very own YWC t-shirt. And if you send us an email at ywc@montpelier.org and you give us your size, we'll send you that, and we'll send your pocket constitution from Montpelier.
And Chris, we'd love to see you anytime.
Absolutely.
I'll be the best dressed guy in my constitution club.
Take a picture of yourself, send it to us, and we'll put it on our Facebook page. And since you have volunteered already that you've listened to every single episode, what's your favorite episode of the show?
Oh, boy, I didn't know I was going to get that kind of quiz.
Yeah.
I'll have to get back to you on that one.
Oh, okay.
There's a lot of good ones out there. I think... one of the most interesting ones was when we put Jesus on trial.
That was a good one, wasn't it?
That was a very, very interesting one.
Yeah, that was the fellow from Wisconsin, or if was he from Minnesota, I forget off the top of my head. But he goes around, he's very concerned about the death penalty, and he actually has something he calls the Trial of Jesus, and he goes to various typically religious organizations and churches, and he actually has a trial for blasphemy and prosecutes and defends it. And that's a fun episode. I'll have to remember
very,
that
very
one.
Very fun.
Yeah, in fact, what do we call that episode? It was called Who Would Jesus Kill or something of that sort. Anyway, we've done so many, I can't even remember them all. You're more of an expert than I am, Chris, but thanks very much for playing. We appreciate your time, and thank you, Doug.
You bet.
All right, thanks very much.
It's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with John Ragosta, the author of a book called Religious Freedom, Jefferson's Legacy, America's creed. Before the break, we were talking about Jefferson's probably his crowning achievement, the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom. It begins with some ringing language.
Whereas Almighty God hath created the mind free, that all attempts to influence by temporal punishments or burdens or by civil incapacitations tend only to beget habits of hypocrisy. God made our minds free. When the government tries to control our minds, especially with religion, having some formal relationship with religion, it's hypocritical.
It's an extraordinary document, and if I recall my history correctly, it was first proposed in 1779. It didn't go anywhere, and then it came back to a head in 1785, 1786, and that's when the Memorial and Remonstrance came into the story,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Madison, Jefferson's actually in Paris at the time the statute's adopted. He's ambassador in Paris. And so his good friend, lieutenant, in many respects, James Madison, picks up the ball. He's actually fighting Patrick Henry at the time, and Madison issues the Memorial and Remonstrance, which is also an extraordinary document. And he lays out paragraph after paragraph of why we need religious freedom, why we need separation of church and state. And he begins, every paragraph begins, because. And he has 14 paragraphs.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because one of the best things about these two seminal documents about religious freedom that everyone, not just every American, but everyone should read, is that they're both short. You can Google these, and you can read them in 5 minutes if you want to, and you can obviously spend as much time as you want on them, but these are quick reads.
They're both relatively short, and as you say, not just Americans should read them. Everybody should, and everybody did. Jefferson, sitting in Paris, once the statute's adopted, he has it translated into French. He has it translated into German, and he's spreading it around Europe. It's translated into Latin in Austria and introduced into their parliament, word for word, the Jefferson Statute. Very powerful document. One other factor that people forget, though, that Madison writes this beautiful Memorial and Remonstrance, very Enlightenment, you know, politically motivated. At the same time, there are dozens of petitions from evangelical Baptists and Presbyterians, deeply religious people, deeply committed religious people, saying we demand separation of church and state. Our religion doesn't work when it's influenced by government. Government corrupts religion. Religion corrupts government. We demand, as religious people, that you separate church and state.
You know, this is just the most remarkable thing, is that, and you can even trace it back earlier to Roger Williams up in Rhode Island. So much of the impetus to separate church and state came from religious people who didn't want a bunch of hypocrites sitting in their pews simply because they'd be penalized otherwise.
Exactly. John Leland, one of the great Baptist ministers in Virginia, you know, he says, if government even endorses my religion, people will think that I'm religious for the loaves and fishes. Which is a great line, you know. And he says, no, you know, God doesn't want me to be religious because government tells me that I ought to be religious. God wants me to be religious because I've made my own personal commitment. So yeah, the real genesis of separation of church and state is very strong support from 18th century evangelicals.
You know, I have to have a question here, and I know we're getting slightly off the narrative that you're about to go on to, but I've heard people say that Jefferson wasn't really as familiar with Roger Williams as one might think he was. Did you find any evidence either way about any influence that Roger Williams might have had on Jefferson's thought?
Yes, I'm very sorry to the Rhode Islanders. Roger Williams, what he writes is beautiful and very intelligent about religion and church and state. I find very little evidence that people were aware of it at the end of the 18th century. They're not quoting it, they're not citing it, they're not talking about it. So he's certainly there, but it's hard to find the historic link. And in fact, for example, Jefferson, when he talks about religious freedom in the other states, he focuses on Pennsylvania, William Penn, who's also a great supporter of religious freedom. He doesn't talk about Rhode Island.
That is remarkable, and I don't want to get too far off topic, but Roger Williams came up with a lot of these same ideas about 100 years earlier, and really fought for them, and is quite a hero. But you know, it has always struck me as being an example of how even great thoughts can be lost if they're not carefully preserved, if they're not disseminated properly. In fact, it's a great argument for freedom of speech. that an idea, even a wonderful idea like this, can be lost because, you know, maybe just the papers don't get published or they don't get distributed.
Exactly. And it's why it's so important to have things like the Virginia Statute and like Madison's Memorial and Remonstrance reprinted and reread so that we don't forget.
And now available on Google. Okay, I think we've now established how important these two documents are,
right,
how and significant so, they were at the time. And so you were saying that as the 19th century went on, each of the states started moving in the Jeffersonian direction. And if I recall, you were going to tell me about the North Carolina ratification debates.
Right. So in North Carolina, for example, they're having this debate. At that time, North Carolina said, if you want to be a government official, you have to be a Protestant. And so the question is, are we going to change that requirement? And somebody stands up and says, we should remember what that great patriot, great thinker Thomas Jefferson said. And they read the preamble to the Virginia Statute for Establishing Religious Freedom into the record. And again, it's, you know, it's a page long. They read this into the record word for word. And the debate goes on for a little while. And somebody else stands up and says, you know, that's not good enough. And he rereads the entire preamble and the operative paragraph at the end. There's a paragraph at the end that the first person had left off. So he rereads it. And this gets reported in the newspaper. So I know that each one of these states is changing their religious freedom clauses, moving them in a Jeffersonian direction. But my question was, is it Jefferson? Well, sometimes he's quoted, as in North Carolina. In Rhode Island and West Virginia, they use his language. In Rhode Island, in the debates, I can find no references to Jefferson at all. But when they modify their constitution in the early 19th century, they use word for word the language from Jefferson's statute for establishing religious freedom.
So they were just plagiarizing Jefferson.
Just plagiarizing Jefferson. But the point is, they understood this is what it means to talk about religious freedom. In Connecticut, in Maryland, in New Hampshire, in Vermont, in Massachusetts, when I look at the public debates and I look at what's going on politically, that in Maryland, the delegate who was pushing for reform of their religious provisions, which were relatively restrictive, was a Jeffersonian, that he admired Jefferson, he read Jefferson, he thought in Jeffersonian terms. In New Hampshire, there's a newspaper article that comes out during the congressional, during the constitutional debates in New Hampshire, and says that if we are going to be true Republicans in the Jeffersonian manner, we need to eliminate these restrictions on religious freedom. So again, I'd say to my students, how do you know? Well, the newspapers are saying it's Jefferson and Madison. The changes in the constitutions are moving in a Jeffersonian, Madisonian manner. They are doing so based on a Jeffersonian, Madisonian perspective. And sometimes they'd get it wrong. Louisiana was fascinating. Somebody stands up in their constitutional convention. And again, the issue there was you had an established Catholic church before Louisiana becomes part of the United States, because it had been French and then Spanish. And so they're having a debate at the Constitutional Convention. What should we do about religious freedom? And somebody stands up and he gets it all wrong. I mean, he's just wrong. He says, well, the reason we have the First Amendment is because the Baptists were trying to take over the government and establish the Baptist Church as the national religion. Which is complete poppycock. It's ridiculous. but then he says, but, you know, Jefferson put a stop to it, also poppycock. But he then talks about religious freedom in a Jeffersonian voice.
So he got the gist of it, even though he got all the lead-up facts wrong.
Right. And so, you know, okay, it seems to me this is strong evidence, Justice Rehnquist. You want to talk about those states that had different provisions, but they all move it, and they move it in Jeffersonian direction. Then I started looking, where else would you look? You know, it's a question you ask your students. What else would you look to? I started looking at textbooks in the early 19th century. What does an educated person read in the 19th century when they want to understand religious freedom? And I'm finding in Bancroft, in Howison, in Burke, which are big name 19th century histories. Bancroft is probably the most famous 19th century historian. He says, this is a quote, "The preamble to the Bill for Establishing Religious Freedom, drawn by Jefferson, expressed the ideas of America."
Wow, that's pretty strong.
Very strong. And others will talk about Madison. So Howison is talking about Madison's Memorial and Remonstrance and the statute. Burke's History of Virginia talks about the statute. Was to crush forever the internal antagonism of artificial aristocracy. Okay, so that's pretty strong evidence. So again, I continued down this line of trying to engage Justice Rehnquist's question, and I came to another way to look at it. Well, is there someone else? Is there someone else who had a different view than Jefferson that people relied upon?
That was actually going to be my next question. Where was the competing doctrine? Where was the competing thought, the competing ideology?
And Justice Rehnquist talks about this, as do Scalia and Thomas and some of their dissents or their opinions now. And one of the people they point to that, Stuart, you'll be very familiar with, is Justice Joseph Story.
Really?
Justice Joseph Story takes a very narrow view of religious freedom. He has no problem with cooperation of church and state. And in Story's Commentaries on the Constitution, one of the most famous 19th century legal treatises on the Constitution, he takes a non-Jeffersonian view. And he says that the proper relationship between church and state is that you have in Massachusetts. He says it's a pointed affirmation of the proper understanding of the First Amendment is what we do in Massachusetts.
What was being done in Massachusetts?
Well, you still had a state church. You still had taxes that were paid to support the local minister. And what made that proper for Justice Story was that each town got to vote on what minister they would support. So if your town had more Baptist people, they would vote Baptist. If your town had more Congregationalists, they'd vote Congregationalists, more Presbyterians or Catholics. So Justice Story says this is fair. This is the proper understanding for the First Amendment. We just don't want to have the government picking which church succeeds. And again, Justice Rehnquist expressly relies on Story and refers to him as a founder. Well, there's some problems with that theory. First of all, Justice Story is not a founder. He was 9 years old when the First Amendment was adopted.
Well, perhaps he was just precocious.
He was precocious, yeah. He was really, when you think it was Jefferson and Madison and Hamilton, it was really Story at 9 years old. No, he's not a founder. But the really big problem with Story is that he publishes his text in, I believe it was 1835, which was the year that Massachusetts establishment was brought up in a referendum before the people of Massachusetts, and it was rejected 10-1.
I was waiting for you to say that because I was figuring Massachusetts was just about to abolish its state religion.
Exactly. So the Story's a dinosaur, okay? And I don't find anybody quoting Story. I find newspaper editors, as they're debating religious freedom, quoting Jefferson, quoting Madison. They're not quoting Story. And he's just out of touch. I mean, he's a New England Federalist, essentially. He has to convert to Republican to get appointed to the court, but he comes from a Federalist background. He's a Congregationalist. He's a Puritan. And so that doesn't work. Well, who else? The historian Daniel Dreisbach at American University says, well, why should we look at Jefferson? There are other views in the 19th century, the 18th century. And he points to a fellow named Jasper Adams. You ever heard of Jasper Adams?
I was just searching my memory in vain for anyone named Jasper, let alone Jasper Adams.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with John Ragosta, the author of a book called Religious Freedom, Jefferson's Legacy, America's Creed. And in this book, John is discussing the question. He's questioning a premise. Why is it that we always talk about Thomas Jefferson? Weren't there other people who also have had opinions throughout American history on this very important subject? After the break, we'll come back and we'll answer that question and many others with John Ragosta. Stick around. And now let's finish our discussion with John Ragosta, the author of a book called Religious Freedom, Jefferson's Legacy, America's Creed. John's trying to figure out who were some of the other leading voices on the subject of religious freedom in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. And one of the fellows he came up with is a guy named Jasper.
Nobody ever heard of Jasper Adams, even in the 19th century. He was an Anglican priest. He's the president of Charleston College, and he writes this long sermon, which he then has published, and he's giving it to people for free. He's passing it out. He has the Episcopal Church in South Carolina passing this thing out. And it takes a very non-Jeffersonian view. It says, of course, church and state have to cooperate. Don't be ridiculous. The republic can't live without close cooperation between church and state. There's a problem. I try to find references to Jasper Adams in the literature. I find 5 references. So again, I've got over 100 extensive quotations of Jefferson's statute, Madison's memorial and remonstrance, Jefferson's letter to the Danbury Baptists saying we need a wall of separation between church and state. I find 5 references to Jasper Adams. 4 of them are in religious journals. 3 of them are announcements of his publication that he's passing out to people. And 1 is by a future dean of Tulane Law School, who in Jeffersonian terms absolutely trashes Jasper Adams.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
And says, don't be ridiculous. That's not what America's about. America's about religious freedom as Jefferson understood it, as Madison understood it, that we want a vibrant religious sector, but that has to be separated from government.
Well, John, it's beginning to sound as if when you looked for people who were opposing the Jeffersonian view, you're coming up with a situation. You found a few global warming deniers is what you found.
In essence, that's right. Now,
one guy you can't put in that category. Yeah, I was about to say, but you've mentioned Patrick Henry, and he was, of course, Jefferson's great nemesis, especially on this issue. In fact, it was he, as you've pointed out, who was trying to reimpose an established state and reimpose taxes in Virginia to support the Anglican Church when the whole battle over the Statute of Religious Freedom came up and the Memorial and Remonstrance was published. Is Henry influential past that point in terms of religious freedom?
Very good point. And also Alexander Hamilton might be mentioned. John Adams might be mentioned. They have a much more restrictive view. But Patrick Henry is probably the best example. In fairness to Henry, by the way, his proposal for reestablishing taxes also was nominally non-discriminatory. The idea is you'd ask every person when they paid their tax, Stuart, you owe us $5 for your religion tax. What minister do you want us to give this to? The Baptist minister, Presbyterian minister, Anglican minister? You tell us, and that's who we'll give the money to. So nominally non-discriminatory. But Madison says that's wrong, and Madison and Jefferson win. But Patrick Henry is not remembered, even at the time, for his position on religious freedom. So newspapers are not quoting him. To the extent that that battle comes up, the battle between Henry supporting church-state cooperation and Madison and Jefferson insisting on church-state separation, to the extent that debate is discussed in the early 19th century, it's discussed by people saying Jefferson and Madison won. God bless Patrick Henry, but Jefferson and Madison, that's the vision for American religious freedom.
So he's always remembered for the liberty or death speech, and he did lots of cool things during the Revolution, but his views on religious freedom, Henry's views, simply didn't have much influence in the 19th century.
They don't get traction, and partially because the people who Henry was most affiliated with in Virginia were the Baptists and Presbyterians, former dissenters, and they abandoned Henry on this issue. In fact, he's a little bit angry they abandoned him on this issue. But they abandon him and say, no, we lived under church-state cooperation, and we know that it creates hypocrites and that it creates abuse and that it creates persecution. And as I said before, the evangelicals come out very strongly in support of Madison and Jefferson.
So you've painted a picture now, a very convincing one, that the Jeffersonian-Madisonian view is basically, it's a tidal wave that's covering each of the new states, it's changing their constitutions, and then that takes us to the Reynolds case in the late 19th century, where it was actually ensconced in the Supreme Court canon.
Right. And okay. The Supreme Court unanimously says, if you want to understand religious freedom, you read Jefferson, you read Madison.
Okay. Could you describe that case to us a little bit, the Reynolds case, how it came up and how that quote came up?
Sure. It's a curious case because it's actually, as I said, the Mormon polygamy case.
Right.
And, the Mormons who had been chased out of New England, chased out of Illinois, chased out of Missouri, fairly brutally, mind you. They were being very unfairly, very terribly persecuted, end up out west. They go into the Salt Lake City area. They initially wanted to be an independent republic, but they eventually agree that it's going to be a state. But they continue to practice polygamy, which is made illegal, and they take it to court and seek to defend polygamy on religious freedom grounds, which, by the way, ought to start sounding an awful lot like things going on in Indiana and Arkansas. And it's a similar argument. And what the court says, they say, okay, look, this is the first time we've really had to analyze this First Amendment language on religious freedom in detail. They rely on Jefferson's letter to the Danbury Baptists, calling for a wall of separation between church and state. They rely on Madison's memorial and remonstrance. And in essence, what they're doing, which relates to the religious freedoms issues we face today, is adopting the Jefferson idea of neutrality, that government must be neutral vis-a-vis religion and non-religion. What that means in the polygamy case is if polygamy has been made illegal, it's illegal for everybody. That is a facially neutral law, which is to say it's not a law that was passed with a particularly religious purpose, it has social purpose. Now, you may say the court's wrong, that was really a religious law, but the court says, look, this is basically neutral, and you have to abide by neutral laws regardless of your own personal religious beliefs. And Jefferson had said that. He used the example of what if you had a war and you need wool to make uniforms for the soldiers, and you need wool to make clothing, and you ban the slaughter of sheep. You can't slaughter lambs. Could a Jewish person complain that their religion requires a lamb for Passover? And Jefferson says, no. Yes, this impairs your religious practice, but it's a facially neutral law. If you passed a law that said Jewish people can't slaughter lambs, that's a violation of religious freedom. But if you have a neutral law, that's not a violation of religious freedom.
And to fast forward just slightly over 100 years, that is still the law of the land, that neutral, generally applicable laws are enforceable against everyone, and we don't have to accommodate anyone's religious practices as long as those things are qualified, as long as those things exist.
Right. And so the Liberty University case, I mean, there's a Supreme Court case. Liberty University says we believe it's a violation of our religion to allow black students and white students to date. And the court pretty quickly says, yeah, you don't get away with that. The law saying you can't discriminate against people based on race has nothing to do with religion. It's not targeted at you. It's not targeted at Baptists or Christians or Jews or Muslims. It's a neutral law. We don't care that you say your religion requires you to discriminate. You can't do it.
Right. And before we jump straight to Indiana, let's go back to Utah. And I just want to, again, pause and say that as of, was it 1879, I think, the Reynolds
1879.
Case? 1879, the Reynolds case. At that point, this movement in favor of the Jeffersonian viewpoint has now been ensconced in a unanimous Supreme Court opinion. And from that point forward, it seems that the issue is settled as much as any constitutional issue is settled. But then apparently that consensus started breaking up sometime in the 20th century. What happened there?
Well, how it starts to break down, and by the way, the Jeffersonian consensus, the majority of the Supreme Court would still agree that the Jeffersonian vision of separation of church and state is fundamental. A lot of people would point out it starts to break down. You get different views from historians. I tend to agree with those who say it starts to break down after Brown versus Board of Education, because you have people like Jerry Falwell. Jerry Falwell in the early 1950s said, look, we have strict separation of church and state. You can't use government money to fund Christian schools. You can't give government money to church schools. Now, why does Jerry Falwell say that in the early 1950s? Because all the Christian schools are Catholic schools. And so Falwell is a big supporter of strict separation of church and state. Well, you then get Brown versus Board of Education saying that we have to integrate schools in the South and throughout the country. And suddenly we have dozens and hundreds of little Christian academies popping up all over the South, which are really about keeping white children in Christian academies and not admitting blacks because they're private schools. They could do that, they thought. Suddenly Jerry Falwell changes his position and says, don't be ridiculous. The government should be supporting private, even religious education in a non-discriminatory manner. So you ought to give money to any private school, even if it's religious.
And let's just pause right there and note the remarkable irony there, because I believe that Falwell's church was at least nominally a Baptist church. And as you've mentioned several times, it was the Baptists who were the newcomers. They were the oppressed minority. Some of them back in the day, back in Virginia before the Revolution, were put in prison for preaching. Baptist ministers put in irons in prison in Virginia. And it was indeed seeing that happen was one of the things that really turned Madison against religious establishments. I mean, he wrote letters to college classmates of his complaining about this, I think it was, hell-conceived idea of
Right. Exactly, the diabolical, hell-conceived notion.
Of an established religion. And so it was the Baptists who were complaining, but if I understand you correctly, once powerful Baptist groups like the Jerry Falwell group got into power, then they turned right around and wanted to establish their own religion in some sense.
Right. Now, again, it's not all Baptists.
Some. Right.
Many remember that history. As you say, over half of the Baptist ministers in Virginia were jailed before the American Revolution for preaching.
Over half. I mean, that's just so remarkable.
Over half. It's remarkable. And people seem to have forgotten that history, and that is why the Baptists were so strongly in favor of the strict separation of church and state. But anyway, people would say Brown versus Board of Education. Some people would say it's the early 1960s cases on Bible reading in the schools. People say you can't have prayer in school. Of course you can have prayer in school. People pray in school all the time. You can't have government prayer in school, is what the case says.
It's a cliche, but I've always enjoyed it. What's the old joke that there'll be prayer in school as long as there are math tests, right?
Absolutely. And nothing prevents that. And that's an important distinction. And you talk about why do things start to get more complicated in the 1970s, 1980s. Part of it is we're facing more complicated questions. So there's not going to be any official Bible reading, any official prayer in school. Well, could students have a Bible club after school? And the answer is yes, they can, as long as it's students and it's not a school-sponsored event. Well, can students pray at a graduation ceremony? And again, it's basically, I think the court actually has been fairly intelligent in most of these cases and fairly consistent. And what they've said is the government, keep in mind the principal's the government. He's a state employee. The teachers are the government. They're employed by the state. The government cannot mandate a prayer at graduation. You can't put it in the program. Everybody stand up, we've got our sponsored prayer. That's a violation of the Constitution. If your valedictorian is permitted to speak at graduation, and that valedictorian happens to want to say a prayer, you also can't stop that. But that also means that valedictorian may be saying a Jewish prayer, maybe saying a Muslim prayer, maybe saying a Pastafarian prayer, maybe saying a satanic prayer.
Yes, that's
okay.
Because if you have a policy that the valedictorian gets to say whatever he or she wants, then you might not like what comes out of his or her mouth.
Right. And we've seen this again. So the cases are becoming more complicated. We see this every Christmas where, you know, people want to have a creche scene on the public courthouse lawn. And the answer is, yeah, okay, you can do that, but you have to then allow other people to put up displays. And we had a Satanist display in Florida. We had a Satanist display in Michigan this past Christmas. That's an abomination. Well, I agree it's an abomination. But you can't fix it by saying we're only going to have a Christian display. The way to fix it is say, look, put your Christian display at your church, put your Christian display in your private property, put it at your business if you want, but don't ask the government to speak on religion, because if they speak on religion, then everybody gets their voice.
Well, we're getting a little short on time, so let's return to our starting point. If I recall, you said it was Justice Rehnquist's statement in the Wallace versus Jaffrey case, I think it was 1985, that first made you question why Jefferson and what does Jefferson say. Now that we've established why Jefferson, please tell us why you disagree with Chief Justice Rehnquist's assessment of our need to look to others rather than to Jefferson.
Well, as we've been discussing, I mean, I think that the Jeffersonian vision is clearly the historic understanding in the end of the 18th century and in the early 19th century. Whether we need to rely on that today, that's a complicated question of originalism. Should the court only look at what was understood in the 18th and 19th century? But I think we've gotten a little bit off track in our modern debate, because one of the things that people say is, see, Jefferson wants a secular nation, and we've ended up in this dichotomy. And I think this is where Rehnquist was coming from, and I think it's a false dichotomy of we're either a Christian nation or we're a secular nation. Well, it's a false dichotomy, and certainly one that Jefferson would not have accepted or endorsed. Jefferson wants a secular government, but he is a very religious person. He does not expect the nation to be secular. And he certainly thinks that people in their churches, in their homes, when they're walking down the street, when they're exercising their personal views, are absolutely free to be religious. And Jefferson's religious. Jefferson prays in both of his inaugural addresses. But his view is that's not an official statement. That's Thomas Jefferson saying a prayer during his inaugural address. He thinks it's unconstitutional to have the Congress declare a day of thanksgiving and prayer. That's different. That's an official statement.
Right.
So I think Rehnquist is really coming from a almost a false dichotomy, and he's trying to write Jefferson out because he doesn't like separation of church and state, because he views that as an attack on religion. And again, I can't speak for Justice Rehnquist, obviously, but that's been the modern view, that separation of church and state is an attack on religion, and that's just not true. That's not what Jefferson understood.
Well, going back all the way to the beginning, or even in some sense before the beginning, all the way back to Roger Williams, said that the argument's always been that if you have a secular government, and if the government stays out of religion, then that will allow religion to flourish. And it's notable, isn't it, that the United States, with its largely secular government, is among the most religious nations in the world.
Absolutely. And I point this out in my book. I said, in England, they still have an established church. Nobody goes to church. In Italy, they still put crucifixes on the walls in the schools because you have an established church. But people don't go to church. In Germany, you still have taxes to support religion, but people don't go to church. In America, we have religious radio programs, we have religious music, we have dozens of different churches all over the country, in storefronts, in churches, in synagogues, in mosques, and we have this very vibrant religion. And again, this isn't new. Jefferson understood this. The dean at Yale, back in the early 18th century, had attacked Jefferson viciously on this grounds and said, separation of church and state, you're going to destroy religion. And it's an outrage. You're a heathen. Jefferson was called all sorts of names. You're a heathen. You're anti-religious. About 20 years later, after they had seen what was happening, the dean of Yale comes back, the president of Yale comes back and says, this is the best thing that ever happened to religion, was to get the government out, because now we can really be a vibrant, personally motivated, personally religious people.
Well, John Ragazza, this has been a fascinating discussion and a fascinating book. And what's the title of the book again?
The book is Religious Freedom, Jefferson's Legacy on America's Creed.
And all the people who have reviewed it have talked about how well written it is and what a good and accessible book it is. I can second that. You were kind enough to send me a copy some weeks ago. I have enjoyed it immensely. I'm guessing that it's available on Amazon as well as in your local neighborhood bookstore, right?
Absolutely. You can get it on Amazon. It's published by the University of Virginia Press, so you can get it from UVA Press. There's lots of places to find it.
Well, I encourage everyone to run out and buy 10 copies and give them as Christmas presents to everyone this next year. And thank you very much, John. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Stuart. It's a pleasure.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to John Ragazza and talking to us about how important Thomas Jefferson was when it comes to religious freedom in this country. I'll just put in a little plug here for James Madison, but between the two of them, they were the guys. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. Our Madison Minute, which we didn't have today, sorry, Jim, is by the incomparable Jim Blaylock. And today, of course, we have with us Rechna, a recent graduate of University High. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.